From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we meet one of America's pioneering folklorists. Alan Lomax's early recordings documented the songs and stories of Leadbelly, Jelly Roll Morton, and Woody Guthrie. You can see Lomax's new work on the public television series American Patchwork. Also, we'll hear from a singer-songwriter and guitarist from England who was influenced by American folk music and blues. He's John Wesley Harding. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead tells us about two new albums by jazz trumpeter Kenny Wheeler. And television critic David Bianculli reviews the new Showtime movie, Fear, starring Ali Sheedy. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The first refugees from Tirana, the capital of Albania, are being airlifted to asylum. More than 6,000 Albanians have taken refuge in foreign embassies during the past week. Pierre Vickery reports that a special Czechoslovak plane is carrying 51 refugees to Prague.
The group was the first to leave Albania since thousands of would-be refugees began occupying foreign embassies last week. Two of the 51 have expressed an interest in remaining in Czechoslovakia. The remainder plan to travel on to third countries, like the United States or West Germany. Meanwhile, the Hungarian ambassador has announced that a special plane is expected in Tirana on Friday to transfer the refugees in the Hungarian embassy to Budapest. For National Public Radio, this is Pierre Vickery in Zagreb.
Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev today announced the formation of a 22-member delegation to hold talks with the breakaway Republic of Lithuania. The delegation, which consists of lawmakers, government representatives, and union officials, will be headed by Soviet Prime Minister Nikolai Ryzhkov. In an agreement that ended the Kremlin's economic embargo on Lithuania, the Parliament of the Baltic Republic agreed to place a 100-day moratorium on its declaration of independence. The moratorium is to go into effect the day talks with Moscow begin. Rioting in Kenya spread to three major towns outside Nairobi today in the third straight day of street violence. The fighting erupted Saturday when police tried to stop a public rally calling for a multi-party democracy to replace 21 years of one-party rule. NPR's Daniel Zwerdling reports from Nairobi.
Government officials have reportedly told police to use whatever force is necessary to stop the rioting, which suggests that the current death toll, 5, is likely to rise. But events took an especially ominous turn this afternoon when government police and paramilitary troops began to take part in the rioting themselves. According to eyewitnesses, government forces essentially took over a small village on the northern edge of Nairobi and went shop to shop, house to house, banging on doors and demanding citizens to give them money, and then beating up people who refused. U.S. Embassy officials have instructed everyone in the American diplomatic community here to lock themselves at home until further notice. I'm Daniel Zwerdling in Nairobi.
Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir's right-wing coalition government survived its first vote of no confidence today. Leftist opposition parties had called for the vote, charging the Shamir government with failing to provide enough housing for the flood of Soviet Jewish immigrants. The opposition also challenged a government plan to allow Jewish settlers to operate a civil guard in the occupied territories. The government prevailed by a vote of 60-51 in the 120-member Israeli parliament. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrials gained 9 points to close at 2,914. This is NPR News. Two veteran space shuttle commanders were disciplined and grounded today for violations of safety rules. One of the pilots, Navy Commander Robert Hoot Gibson, was grounded after flying in an air race this weekend in Texas. His stunt plane collided with another plane, and the other pilot was killed. Gibson was suspended under rules that prevent expensively trained shuttle pilots from taking part in high-risk activities. Also grounded was Navy Captain David Walker, who was disciplined for what was reported as a near mid-air collision last year with a Pan Am Airbus. NASA officials have announced they're a step closer to solving the fuel leak problem that's grounded the shuttle fleet. Preliminary reports are in from a key lab test of the pipes and valves that connect the shuttle to its external fuel tank. NPR's Michael Scholar has more.
Both the Columbia and Atlantis shuttles sprang leaks on the launch pad. Atlantis is still on the pad, but Columbia's leaky fuel pipes were taken out and sent to California for testing. The good news is that the connecting pipes did leak during the lab test. If they had not leaked, NASA would have been stuck in its search for the launch pad problem. The bad news, says NASA's William Lenore, is that they still don't know which particular seal connecting the pipes is leaking.
We have eliminated none of the seals from our suspects list.
But they think the problem may be the main seal at the joint where the shuttle hydrogen fuel pipe has to disconnect from the external fuel tank during flight. New lab tests should eventually spot the problem seal, but NASA officials now worry their routine testing procedures before flight aren't good enough to catch problems of this sort early on. This is Michael Scholar in Washington.
Louisiana Governor Buddy Romer isn't saying whether or not he'll veto a compromise bill that could become the strictest anti-abortion law in the nation. The compromise bill contains exceptions for rape and incest, but a requirement that the rape be reported within 7 days of its occurrence may be too narrowly drawn to satisfy Romer. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
So long, it's been good to know you. So long, been good to know you. So long, it's been good to know you. This dusty old dust is a-blowing me home. I've got to be rolling along.
The Woody Guthrie Library of Congress recordings preserve the songs and stories of one of America's most influential folk singers. The recordings were made by my guest Alan Lomax. Lomax has devoted his life to the study of folk culture in America and around the world. His father, John Lomax, was one of the first popularizers of American folk songs. The father and son were the first folklorists to travel around the American South, recording songs on portable record machines. They both contributed thousands of field recordings to the Library of Congress's Archive of American Folk Song, which John Lomax founded in 1941. Alan Lomax went on to develop a system for measuring cultural differences in music and dance from around the world. For many years, he's directed a research project on the subject at Columbia University. You can see his latest work in a new 5-part public television series called American Patchwork. The series showcases Cajun culture, Mississippi blues, Appalachian culture, and New Orleans jazz parades.
Well, the idea was that this is the country of the common man, the people, as Sandburg used to call them, and that the basic creativity of America had manifested itself at the grassroots. And I wanted to tell some of the most important stories because I wanted to connect through them American groups with their deep past, the blacks with their deep past in Africa, Europe with their deep past, Northwest Europeans with their deep pasts in the lands just below the Arctic Circle. And that's what I tried to do, to dramatize the meeting of these two very different but somehow kindred groups on this continent, because America is the land of encounters. It's the endpoint for human migrations. The whole human culture, the whole human race has debauched its cultures here and is still bringing new things with every boatload of people from Asia and Latin America.
You've sure seen technology change in recording folk culture over the years. Now, in your early days, you used one of the first portable recording machines, right?
Actually, the first machine that my father and I took out was a Thomas Edison cylinder machine. And then the Library of Congress kindly replaced that with a disc machine that embossed the groove on an aluminum disc. But for a long time, I was a media bug because I saw that the job of the folklorist was to make a bridge between people who had no voice and the big world of communication. And that's what I did for the first, half of my life, was simply run with a recording machine and record. In here, in the West Indies, in Italy, in Spain, in Great Britain, and to encourage other people to do it and to publish the results, because this was the way that people could learn that other folks were out there just as interesting as they were. That's the first big lesson of the recording machine.
When you first started recording, you were a teenager and you were on the road with your father. What were your responsibilities in those very early days?
Well, basically, I ran the machine and lifted it and carried it. The whole thing weighed about 500 pounds, and I broke it down and put it in the back of our Ford Model A Ford, often two or three times a day, It kept the fat off of me.
Were you interested in this, or were you just doing this to please your father when you were a teenager?
Well, no. I mean, I was an anthropologist in college and a radical, and I wanted to go along to see what was happening in the South. I'd been a Southern kid, and I knew that what my middle class surround said, which was that blacks were perfectly content with their lot, was a lot of hooey. But I couldn't prove it because you couldn't get any information on the subject. There was nobody who was talking out of school. It was too dangerous. And so I went out to see what I could find out in the background of the recording sessions. And gradually, I began to learn how to get to know blacks, even though it was dangerous for them and to some extent for me.
Your father had been fired from his position at the University of Texas for recording cowboy songs, which were considered very dirty at the time. What was the reputation of folk music then? Did people not really understand what it was about? I mean, so much so that your father would be fired for for taking it down?
Well, I think that is part of the same old story that's happening with our Southern North Carolina senator and the NEA. After all, the Puritan West Europeans really haven't ever had very much use for art. Or for recreation, or for fun. So the arts have always been something extra. And they had to mind their place. They had to conform to the rules of society. So the big threat, of course, was that the subject of SEX would be mentioned. Remember, America in the 19th century was the most hung-up part of the whole world, or maybe ever had been, on the question of sex. Women were just untouchable. So anyway, my father was kicked out of the university for collecting cowboy songs on the grounds that some of them were dirty. They weren't, not in his book. And then later on at the Library of Congress, when I was running the folk song archive there, the archive was shut down by a rabid born-again Southern who attacked it because we had recorded that rantankerous, rambling ballad maker, Woody Guthrie. He just then, by the way, composed This Land Is Your Land, and I just recorded it for the Library of Congress. But they were so severe about it that they cut the whole Library of Congress appropriation out. Later it was put back, but the archive didn't recover for many years. And I think that's just the kind of thing that's happened recently.
Folklorist Alan Lomax is my guest, and he has a new series of TV programs about regional folk culture in the United States. It's on public television, and it's called the American Patchwork Series. Let me get back to the days when you were on the road traveling through the South recording songs. You and your father were, I think, the first people to actually record in prison camps in the South. Why did you want to go there to record songs?
Well, there's always been an anomaly in the black community. All secular songs, and this follows out my Calvinist hypothesis, were considered sinful. Anything that wasn't religious was sinful. So that the whole of the secular, great secular song art of the black, the blues, the hollers, the work songs, all the casual songs of amusement were forbidden. You could be church. You could be kicked out of the church for singing them if you were a black person in a respectable black community. So that it was very difficult for us to get at this rich and unknown treasure trove of American music and lyricism without in the normal black community. People were scared to sing them, scared of criticism. So we decided to go where the devils were. I mean, the people who were beyond redemption. And we found them in the prisons, and we recorded a whole literature, which is still virtually unknown. Song bag of beautiful tunes, new kinds of melodies, and all sorts of things we found in the prison camps of the South. But the blacks were overjoyed to have a chance to do something, to let their problems be known, and because they had put tremendous a lot of their feelings and sorrows into these songs. They expressed the terrors of their existence. You could say those prison camps were very much equivalent to the concentration camps in Hitler's Germany. They threatened any black who stepped out of line, who looked impudent, who talked back. He might easily end up there, down the chain of lawlessness that then controlled the South.
I think the best known of the recordings that you made of prisoners was your recordings with Leadbelly, and you continued to record him after he got out.
Yeah, we did the first singer biography of him.
Let me play one of the recordings you made by Leadbelly, and this is Midnight Special. Would you like to say a few words about the circumstances under which you recorded it or the song itself? And you might want to tell us, too, how you met Leadbelly.
Well, Leadbelly had been in the Texas pen a couple of times, but we found him in the Louisiana penitentiary where prisoners were not allowed to sing in the fields, but they could have their own entertainers, and Leadbelly was a camp entertainer. He had his guitar there, and we went to camp number one, and when he heard we were there, he ran 100 yards from his cell to where we were, arrived without even breathing hard, and sat down and sang. Irene Goodnight was the first song he sang us, and he sang a song to appeal to the governor of Louisiana to let him out of there, because woman was mourning for him. And then he sang, among other things, the great Midnight Special, which is actually the song of the main theme song of the Texas Penitentiary, Let the Midnight Special Shine Its Ever-Loving Light on You. Think of prisoners who don't know whether they'll live through the next day, who are working from dawn in the morning till dark at night, who, if they fall afoul of a guard, may be beaten to death, hanging on the bars, absolutely stone-weary, wiped out, and watching the headlight of some onrushing train flash across the walls of their prison and into their faces. That's the mood of the song.
That's Leadbelly, and that was recorded by you and your father?
Well, I don't know. I've recorded it so many times with him, I don't know.
I see, okay,
which
right.
Recording was which.
Did Leadbelly write Midnight Special?
No. He recomposed it. All black singers always, you know, remake it. Remake the song they sing. So they say, I'm the composer. Composed by whoever it was, even if they sing a song that's well known from some other source.
When Leadbelly was released from prison, he traveled with your father for a couple of years, and your father put on a lot of concerts for him. Do you have any memories of what it was like for Leadbelly going from the South to the North and suddenly, like, performing for folklorists, for intellectuals, performing at Harvard University? Was there a period of culture shock and serious adaptation for him?
Not at all. He was just in triumph. He, in his mind, and it was true, he was the best in the world. He was the king of the 12-string guitar players in the world. He had a voice you could hear for a mile, an absolutely beautiful silvery tenor voice. It's never been heard, by the way. It's only on our first recordings. It began to go as he lived in the city.
When you were recording musicians, did you ever take co-composer credit for one of their songs? I know that was often the case with people.
No. That came very much later. What happened was that we gave out our songs from the Library of Congress in our books for everybody to use. And then along came all a lot of new people in the field who simply copyrighted them completely. Lonnie Donegan in England copyrighted all of Lead Belly's songs. And in order to protect the material, the only way that the publishing industry saw that I could do it was for me to co-claim them with some of the singers. And I did that. And that made it possible for the singers and their families to get royalties and for money to be to come into my hands so I could continue to do research. That's how it happened.
Why did you have to co-claim them instead of giving them the full credit?
Well, arrangements and rearrangements of the text and so on. And that actually happened. You know, when we printed the books, we actually reworked songs to make them easy to appear in print. See, there was a choice. We had many versions of John Henry or Get Along Little Doggies or what. Were we going to print each of those versions, or were we going to print a composite version? We generally printed a composite version. And that's the way that the songs were popularized, in the composite versions.
So you felt like the editor of the songs?
Yeah, we edited them. And that's made it possible to actually administrate this material for the singers.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. My guest is folklorist Alan Lomax, and he's produced a new series of television programs, which he hosts, about the folk culture of different American regions. It's called The American Patchwork. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Folklorist Alan Lomax is my guest, and his American Patchwork series on public television covers such topics as jazz parades, Cajun culture, the blues, and the music of Appalachia. I want to ask you about, I think, what's considered to be among the most important recordings you've ever made, and I'm thinking of the recordings you made with Jelly Roll Morton, the Library of Congress recordings, which features both him singing and playing, as well as talking about his life. How did you get to make those recordings with him?
Well, as I used a recording machine in the field, I began to discover that what an artist would say about the song at the end of a performance was usually psychologically and emotionally very revealing. And I began to record more and more of these codas to songs. And gradually, the codas began to stretch out longer and longer until I was recording whole life histories. And I had done a number of these by the time Jelly Roll came to the Library of Congress, anxious to prove to the world that jazz was not from Memphis, as Handy had said it was in a Billboard interview, but was from New Orleans. And Jelly Roll, an extraordinary intellectual he was, had the whole story worked out when he came to me in my office, which was backstage of the Coolidge Auditorium, the Library of Congress. On the stage was a grand piano. Around the hall, there were the busts of Bach and Beethoven. Jelly Roll sat down at the piano, completely at home with his peers, because he was, after all, our first literate native composer, and began to tell the story of jazz. Naturally, I was no great friend of jazz at the time, because jazz was what was driving folk music into obscurity, in my view. But this man was so fascinating that I thought I would try to find out how much, well, folklore there was in him. And within an hour, he'd said such wonderful things that I raced upstairs, got permission to work with him for a week and to use any number of discs to take down his life. That's how it all happened.
Let me play a short excerpt of the oral history that you recorded. Jelly Roll Morton is talking about when he started to play in the Tenderloin District in New Orleans.
In my younger days, I was brought in to the Tenderloin District by friends. Young friends, of course. Even before we were in long pants, we used to steal long pants from around the fathers and brothers and uncles and so forth and so on.
Could you go down there before you had long pants on?
No, why, the policeman would run you right in jail. It'd run you ragged. Of course, we kids from time to time would climb those 8 and 10 feet high board fences. We'd really climb them and get away from these people, but they kept us right out of the district. They'd take the straps on the end of the clubs and just make switches out of them, cut our legs into ribbons, and was very frightened of, very much frightened. I happened to invade that section, one of the sections of the district where the birth of jazz originated.
Where was this? How old were you?
At that time, that was the year of 1902. I was about 17 years old. I happened to go to Villeray and Bienville. At that time, one of the most famous night spots after everything was closed. It was no only a back room where all the greatest pianists frequented after they got off from work. All the pianists got off from work in the sporting houses at around 4 or after, unless they had plenty of money involved. And they would go to this Frenchman's. That was the name of the place, Saloon. And there would be everything in the line of hilarity there. They would have even millionaires to come to listen to the different great pianists, what would no doubt be their favorites maybe among them.
Jellero Morton, recorded by my guest Alan Lomax back in 1938. Let's jump ahead to your present project, the American Patchwork Series. Can you share one of your favorite moments that happened during the 5 years that you made the American Patchwork Series?
Well, it's hard to choose one, but maybe the most exciting thing that happened was I had been studying world dance, and I noted that change of level was one of the most important characteristics of black dance, blacks leaping, blacks rolling on the ground. And in the jazz parades, we found people dancing on rooftops, people climbing telephone poles, people dancing under cars, people piling up in the streets. And to watch my cameraman, who had been trained on my dance films, realize the fact that they were looking at Africa in the streets of New Orleans was a very exciting thing.
How do you think your role as folklorist has changed over the years? Or perhaps I should ask, how do you think the role of the folklorist has changed?
Well, so far as I'm concerned, I'm still doing the thing that I was inspired to do in my early recording sessions, when people would look at the microphone and say, "Mr. President, I want you to come down here and help us people where we are in our hard times in this place." They looked at my father and myself as a channel to tell their troubles and to let their lives be known. That's what I've essentially tried to do all my life.
Folklorist Alan Lomax. His series American Patchwork is now running on public television. Rounder Records recently released CDs of Lomax's Woody Guthrie Library of Congress recordings, and Rykodisc just released CDs of Lomax's recordings of conversation and music with Sonny Boy Williamson, Big Bill Brunzi, and Memphis Slim, called Blues in the Mississippi Night. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air, and this is Memphis Slim.
As Nashville, Tennessee used to sing, "Well, have you ever been to Nashville? Well, have you ever been to Nashville? Well, have you ever been to Nashville? Oh, Lordy, the Nashville Pen."
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, providing the Fresh Air staff the power to be their best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
Coming up, we meet a musical newcomer with a familiar name. He's John Wesley Harding, a British singer, songwriter, and guitarist. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews two new CDs by trumpeter Kenny Wheeler, The Widow in the Window and the reissue Double W. And TV critic David Bianculli previews Fear, the new Showtime movie that's a battle of wits between a psychic killer and the psychic out to catch him. It stars Ally Sheedy. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The leaders of the seven industrialized countries were welcomed by President Bush to Houston today with a 21-gun salute and high-powered air conditioning. The opening ceremonies for the 16th Economic Summit meeting were held at Rice University. NPR's John Itzde reports.
Describing it as the first post-war summit, the president called on the national leaders gathered for the summit to set the stage for the new millennium.
Together we're called upon as allies and as friends to work toward decisions here in Houston that will bring a new stability and prosperity to the world by tapping the power and energy of free wills and free markets.
On the agenda at the first meeting this afternoon, trade and macroeconomic issues like inflation and interest rates. The focus of the working dinner tonight, financial aid for the Soviets. The Allies are divided on this issue, but administration officials suggested today that the leaders might agree to send teams of technical experts to help the Soviet Union move toward a market economy. I'm John Itzde in Houston.
NASA officials have grounded two veteran shuttle crew commanders. Commander Robert Hoot Gibson has been grounded for 1 year and Captain David Walker for 60 days for violating Space Center flight crew operations guidelines. Over the weekend, Gibson's stunt plane collided with another aircraft during an air show, and the other plane crashed in a cornfield, killing the pilot. Walker was suspended for a May 1989 incident in which the pilot of a Pan Am Airbus reported a near mid-air collision between his plane and a jet flown by Walker. Fire officials in Alaska say that more than 500,000 acres are now in flames, with wildfires continuing their dramatic spread along the Yukon River. Brian Mann with Alaska Public Radio reports.
Heavy smoke cover prevented officials from mapping the extent of the Yukon River fire until aerial surveys could be done with infrared cameras. Pat Flowers is at the Fire Information Center in Fairbanks.
Based on that flight, they've remapped the fire and estimated it at around 200,000 acres.
That's three times the size firefighters had expected. According to Flowers, fires in Alaska are now so large that they'll continue to grow and continue to burn out of control.
Some of these fires just may not be out until the snow flies. They're that large.
Meanwhile, the village of Togue, just west of the Canadian border, is now free of fire danger, and residents there have returned to their homes. For National Public Radio, I'm Brian Mann in Anchorage, Alaska.
In the midst of a long drought, the Prime Minister of Greece says that Athens could run out of water by November. The government is considering a number of ways to cut down on water use, including giving better rates to those who save water. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 9 points to close at 2,914.11 in light trading. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. There are a lot of new albums out by jazz trumpet players, including 28-year-old Wynton Marsalis, 20-year-old Roy Hargrove, and 19-year-old Marlon Jordan. While their records have been getting a lot of press, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has been listening to trumpet and flugelhorn player Kenny Wheeler. Wheeler was born in Canada, but is a resident of England. Kevin has a review of two of his albums.
If you want to make it big in jazz these days, it helps if you play the trumpet, play it well, and play it pretty. Unfortunately for Kenny Wheeler, who turned 60 this year, it also helps if you're barely old enough to vote. Still, if you ask me, by a lot of criteria, Wheeler is the best jazz trumpet player working now. For one thing, he has a gorgeous tone. It'd be easy for Kenny Wheeler to coast on his sound alone. But he also plays beautifully sculpted solos that don't sound like anyone else's. Wheeler says he's made a conscious effort to play like a saxophonist, which is a real challenge. A saxophone is easier to get around on than a trumpet or flugelhorn. You can hear the results in the way his lines lag behind the beat and leap around from one register to another. I love those little jumps into the stratosphere, where he may hit notes that don't belong in the key he's in. But moves like that may help explain why Kenny Wheeler doesn't have a larger following. As he says, he's too far out for some people, and too far in for others. On the latter point, it's true that his music, like a lot of stuff recorded for the ECM label, can be a little sedate. His new album that I've been playing you snatches from, The Widow in the Window, is a case in point. According to the liner notes, his quintet, with guitarist John Abercrombie and drummer Peter Erskine, had just come off a road trip where the music had gotten pretty hot. They decided to tone it down when they went into the studio. I wish they hadn't done that. A 1983 Wheeler date for ECM, just reissued on CD, finds him in more animated settings. It's called Double W. On both these albums, Wheeler's joined by two frequent collaborators, pianist John Taylor and bass player Dave Holland. Rounding out the band on Double W are drummer Jack DeJohnette and tenor saxophonist Michael Brecker. They play some slow and lyrical pieces, but also some that are geared to Brecker's hard-edged style. I like Wheeler's writing better on Double W than on his new album, mostly because there's more variety. The best tune is called Foxy Trot. It takes some of the same sharp turns Wheeler's solos do, and gives Dave Holland a couple of catchy bass riffs. Kenny Wheeler's albums have something for every jazz fan. Melodies that are attractive and unusual, and solos that are either warm or red hot. Besides his new and newly reissued discs, he also has a large ensemble record coming out later this year. I keep wishing one of these records would get him some of the attention he deserves, but I'm not optimistic. If he could just convince people he's fresh out of high school, now that would probably do the trick.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. This is Fresh Air. Has Elvis Costello's old rhythm section, the Everly Brothers guitarist, Van Morrison's keyboardist, and a name taken from a Bob Dylan record. John Wesley Harding's first American record also shows the influence of his heroes, from Phil Spector to Phil Oakes. John Wesley Harding was working on a doctorate at Cambridge University when he dropped out to begin his rock career. The 24-year-old British singer-songwriter and guitarist is currently in the U.S. In April, while he was on an American tour, he stopped by our studios with his guitar. But before we hear his performance, we have some music from his new album. This is the title track, Here Comes the Groom.
With half an eye on history, half an ounce of hope, sold his soul in the vestry, money borrowed rope, been this way a million times, but now his time is nigh. He steps into the spotlight. He wants to say hi, hello. We're so glad you came. You've never seen me before. Were you so ambitious? Were he so game? Yesterday he was dressed the same, and then it was so much easier to ignore. Here comes the groom.
I have to confess to you that the first time I heard Here Comes the Groom was on the radio. And my first reaction was, oh, this must be from an Elvis Costello record that I haven't heard yet. And I know you've probably heard things about comparisons to Elvis Costello, but I wonder what your reaction to that is.
Well, I'm obviously very, you know, much better looking and thinner than he is, so I'm, you know, I'm quite happy about it. But no, I mean, seriously, it had never occurred to me in the whole of my life, and I've only been writing songs now for about 2.5 years, but it had never occurred to me that I sounded like Elvis Costello. And so when they offered me a band to play with, and I went for the attractions. I mean, if at that time I'd been worried that I was going to end up sounding like Elvis Costello, I mean, I don't think I'd have got the attractions. It would have been a foolish move. Do you know what I mean? And I would have been rather worried about it.
Your bass player and drummer were members of the Attractions, Elvis Costello's band.
Greatest band in the world.
How did you get hooked up with them?
Literally, I knew them through my manager, the Colonel, and you know, I knew them, and I wanted to. We needed a band to get together for the album, and when Sia signed me, they said, "Are you thinking of a band?" I said, "Yeah, we're going to use Pete and Bruce Thomas." They went, "Great, you know, great. That's really good news." And so we used them. And I mean, they are brilliant. That we cut the whole album, but every backing track on this album was cut in 5 days, and only 3 of those were in the studio. The other 2 days were rehearsing.
Why don't we play your single, your single from the new record, "The Devil in Me"? Is there a story behind the song, behind the writing of it?
Well, I'll tell you where I wrote it. I wrote it backstage after I supported Tom Robinson at a Tom Robinson concert, and the phrase kept on popping up to me. The phrase kept on popping up, and I think, like, with the arts that I like, which is like cinema and books, they allow themselves to quote from their own history. You can't understand Wings of Desire, to arty film. You can't understand Wings of Desire unless you know about It's a Wonderful Life. It's a crucial, unwritten element of Wings of Desire. You can't understand Bonfire of the Vanities unless you've read a good Dickens, I think. That, you know, and they quote from themselves. A lot of literature is a response to other literature. Really good. And it's allowed to do that. Rock music doesn't do that. And so what I try and do is, like, in The Devil in Me is meant to be a human sample of Sympathy for the Devil, making a song that was sexy, apolitical, immoral, because that was what the Rolling Stones are about, and nothing wrong with that because they're a great band, and bringing it into the 90s.
Well, I gave you acid rain, and I polluted the sea, and I covered your thoughts up, with graffiti. Well, you can call me back.
You've only been writing songs for, what, a couple of years?
Yeah, 2 or 3 years.
Well, how did you start writing songs?
I remember getting a Bob Dylan songbook and listening to Robert Johnson records. But then within a week of learning, like, GC&D, I'd written a song in it. So, you know.
You play acoustic guitar?
Well, sometimes.
Sometimes. Is it swell to still play acoustic guitar and be portable with it?
Yeah.
To be able to, like, take a guitar into the studio now and just, like, play your songs?
That's
not have to worry about plugging in or it sounding...
And I
electric
go
guitars
to,
sometimes sound funny when they're unaccompanied,
I,
you know?
I mean, I'd never play an electric guitar unaccompanied,
mm-hmm.
apart from when I break a string and I don't have another, apart from my electric guitar. I love to be portable, and that's why. I mean, I've been on tour since January the 17th, and I love it. I mean, it's very tiring, but I can play at a record store. I can walk into a record store and say to the owner, have you heard of me? Do you mind if I play? And generally they go, of course, yes, please. And I play a couple of songs. And if there are people there, they'll go and buy my record.
So what gave you the sense that you could get a record company deal, you know, that
arrogance.
You could make it professionally?
Just, I don't know, arrogance, egomania, sense of humour. I don't know what it was, but I just, you know, it's like my first album, which came out in England, it happened one night. We recorded in an hour, and it cost, like, £200. And I did it like that because out of that kind of mock integrity thing. But not enough people bought it. Not enough people saw it. This is my whole argument with the alternative labels. It's great that Jello Biafra's on this label that you can't buy in most of the shops in the world. Very good, you know, but not for me. You know, I want people to hear my music. And the then what you have to do is say, well, how far do you play the game? What is the game and how far do you want to play it?
As a newcomer, I'm sure that your record company and your management has floated all kinds of ideas about how you should be promoted and what your image should be and all this kind of stuff. Are you in on that?
Well, that's the interesting thing.
Do they have to consult you before saying, we're going to put out this poster?
Nobody does anything without consulting me because they know. I don't know. I mean, I'm sure they don't know it because they know because my power is that of an ant compared to a record company. But, I mean, I'm the one with all the ideas anyway. You know what I mean? I chose the musicians. The producer was foisted upon me, I'm very happy to say. The order of the tracks, the lyrics of the tracks, I made the video, I wrote the video myself, I choose what to sing on stage every night. I mean, nobody's told me what to say in this interview, I wear what I want. I'm completely uninterested in packaging, being packaged in any way for anything other than my songs. I never want to appear in public not wearing the leather jacket that's made me famous, or do you know what I mean? Or without the drink that I advertise. I'm not interested in packaging. And so on the cover of my album, I just put my face with no clothes on, so you can't tell what kind of music it is. It could be any, it could be a white soul singer.
You say you're not into packaging, but your name is in a way packaging since it's not your birth name.
The name, but it's kind of anti-packaging because everybody's first reaction is what an incredibly bad idea, which I really like. Because I've tried to make my career so far a lot of things that other people would spit at and make it work. You know, like the irony of it is that although the name seems like a very calculating move, it really wasn't because my real name is Wesley Harding Stace. And when I used to turn up these Hot House Flowers gig with the guitar over my shoulder, people used to call me John Wesley Harding. It was funny because it was like my name. And it was stuck, and I got billed as it. And it was never a conscious decision. But having said that, I like it because, like, 30 years ago, it was cool to change your name. 20 years ago, it was cool to change your name. 10 years ago, it was cool to change your name. For the last 10 years, it's been like, whoa, what a lack of integrity. You know, because, like, the acoustic guitar, this piece of wood now, is a symbol, you know, like, it sells integrity. People have worked out that you can sell this as a product. Oh, he plays an acoustic guitar. Oh, or in most cases, oh, she plays an acoustic guitar. We can sell it. Let's put one of those on the cover. Make her look depressed. Put some teardrops on the window in front of him. Bit of a blurry photo. Smash album. You know, we'll give it a great review. And I'm not into it. That just seems to be such a boring way to go about your life. So, you know, I think hard about these things, but in the end, I always come out with the most simple answer, which is just forget about it. Do what you want to do.
Can you leave us with another song that you'd play for us here?
Right. Well, I'll sing you something brand new that I wrote two weeks ago, and I played it first in a little club in Athens, Georgia, a couple of weeks ago. But I quite like it. It'll be on the next album one day. I put my forehead to the door. And I heard the famous sound of infidelity. Looks like I loved and lost once more. Oh, but all's fair in love and war, supposedly. I couldn't even burst in on you. See scrabbling sheets, hear your excuse.
give you the evil eye of verbal abuse. Why do you do what you do when the things that you do hurt the person you are? Why do you do what you do when the things that you do hurt the person you are? I slammed the glass down on the bar. My problems, they hit the floor so gracefully. I don't know where I parked the car, but that's okay, 'cause tonight I'm on the town without me. Tonight it's just me and my evil twin, the one who slips one more drink in, the one who slips away when I start sinking. Why do you do what you do when the things that you do hurt the person you are? Why do we do what we do when the things that we do hurt the person we are? It's a rhetorical question. Why do you do what you do when the things that you do hurt the person you are? They hurt the person you are. The person you are. Person. The person.
Singer, songwriter, and guitarist John Wesley Harding. His new album, Here Comes the Groom, is on Sire Records. This is Fresh Air. Coming up later today on All Things Considered, coverage of the opening day of the annual Seven Nation Economic Summit. President Bush welcomed the world leaders to the meetings in Houston. We also hear why the planners of the summit asked one Houston businessman to hide his economic troubles. From Moscow, Ann Cooper reports on today's activities at the Communist Party Congress. Also reports on the first group of refugees to leave Albania. 51 Albanians are heading for Czechoslovakia on President Václav Havel's private plane. Meanwhile, thousands of others are still waiting to get out. Daniel Zwerdling reports on the current crisis in Kenya and a look at the history of predicting the future. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. TV critic David Bianculli says that summertime is the time to check out what the alternative TV sources are providing while CBS, NBC, and ABC are in their summer hibernation. One such opportunity comes this Sunday when the Showtime cable network premieres a telemovie called Fear.
Fear stars Ally Sheedy, who doesn't look any older than when she portrayed a teenager in War Games. She plays Casey Bridges, a young psychic who's working with police to capture a killer on the run. He's got his next victim tied in the back seat, he's driving down a country road, and the only one on his trail is Casey, who's miles away in a precinct house, but is following the car by tuning into the minds of the killer and his captive.
Come on, darling, what have you got for us?
He's on a long dirt road lined with lots of trees. He's taking her inside. Someplace big. It's a barn or a shed at the end of the dirt road. Oh, sweet God, get him. Get him.
This opening scene of Fear is typical of tons of other films about psychics and serial detectives. Very quickly, though, this story goes for something different. In the very next scene, it's 5 years later. Casey is now a best-selling author, having written books about the cases she'd helped solve with her mental powers. And Sheedy, all of a sudden, looks a lot more mature. It's her first grown-up role, and she does pretty well with it. It isn't long before Casey is on the trail of a new serial killer, but this case is different. And, as a result, so is this movie. This time, the psychic communication is two-way. The killer is psychic, too, and he's better at it than she is. He gets off by sensing the deepest fears of his victims and killing them in the very ways they fear the most. Casey understands this, but not because she's mentally eavesdropping on him. It's because, sometimes against her will, he's sending images and messages to her.
Do you feel it?
Yes.
Feel it, Casey. It's the fear. There's no other rush like it in the world.
The knife. She's afraid of the knife.
No!
It's like in some scary movie she saw last night.
God, no!
She was wonderful, Casey. And so were you.
This is a really creepy idea. And writer-director Rockne S. O'Bannon, who did the movie Alien Nation, carries it off most of the way. But I don't think Fear takes full advantage of what is a really good and twisted plot twist. With more imagination, this killer could have been the biggest thing since Freddy Krueger. And the less you expect of the ending, the less you'll be disappointed. Even so, Fear packs as much excitement as any network telemovie did this past season. And during the summer months, there's not that much else worth seeing anyway, even if you are a psychic.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Post. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Voblaitis, Ron Barron, Joyce Lieberman, and Thad Kirk. Chris Burgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, some advice on stopping the greenhouse effect from scientist Michael Oppenheimer. And Douglas Gummery tells us how he went from the downtown movie palace to the shopping mall multiplex. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.
Philadelphia. Good evening, I'm Peter Bryant, welcoming you to Evening Classics for this Monday night here on 91 FM. I'll be sitting in for Melinda Whiting tonight. Well, coming up, we'll be hearing two Symphony No. 6s, the Symphony No. 6 by Dvorak, and also Beethoven's Symphony No. 6, the Pastoral, plus a sonata for violin and piano by Schubert, some music of Handel and Haydn, and much more. And I hope you can stay right here.